Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Chris Thomas. Chris, until recently, was the director of elections for the state of Michigan, a part of the office of the Secretary of State of Michigan. We're going to be talking with him about elections, about his history, you know, and why we do things the way we do. Chris Thomas, With Respect. Chris, how are you today?
I'm very good, John, and yourself?
I'm absolutely wonderful, and I've been wanting to do this for a long time because I have been involved sort of in politics since I was born, or maybe even before, because my family took an interest in it, and we kind of learned about elections and about politics from our parents and our grandparents and friends and family. But there's certain things about elections that I don't understand, and I know that a lot of our listeners might not understand. But let's start with you. Where are you from originally?
I'm from right here in St. Joseph, Michigan, and I was born here in 1949 in Benton Harbor. Grew up in St. Joe. My dad worked at Whirlpool. He was down in the plant, a manager down there, and went to high school here.
Where'd you go to high school?
St. Joe High.
And when did you graduate?
Hey, 50 years ago, 1968. All
right.
Yeah.
Are you going to be a part of the, what is that program where the past grads participate in shows?
That was not my strong suit.
Oh.
I was part of the audience, so I look forward to it, yes. But I had very, very talented classmates.
Did you? All right.
Yeah.
So, Chris, When you were a kid, what were your interests?
I was always interested in government. I was on student council in junior high, and again in high school. Always interested in how things worked with government. So I always just was pointed in that direction. I enjoyed debate, and I enjoyed social studies, and learning about. Not only in school, but what was going on. You know, we went through the 60s. It was a tumultuous time. You know, lots of going on, upheaval, major changes. It really captured my imagination.
Had your parents been involved in politics at all?
No, they really were not. They certainly talked about politics, but my father was not active in any political party. I had an aunt who was, Jane Ashley. She was very active, and back then it was like the Republican women's group. Today she would have been the county chair, no doubt. The times have changed a bit.
Yeah.
So there was activity, and I had an uncle, George Gast, who loved to push my button and pull my string on issues of the day, the Vietnam War, civil rights and whatnot. So I really did a lot of discussion about issues of the day.
How about brothers and sisters? You have any of those, or just an only child?
I am not an only child. I'm the oldest of seven.
Oh, right.
Yes, and the rest of them are following behind here.
How many are those? How many of those kids are in politics or interested in it?
Most of them have an interest. None of them are in politics per se in terms of actually running for office or doing much with the system, but they're very active. They've got very strong opinions. So, yeah, it's always a discussion point.
When you graduated from St. Joe High School, where did you go from there?
Well, my first year of college, I ended up at Grand Valley State College, which was a fascinating college. You literally, at that day, you drove through cornfields up to this college, and I lived on campus. There were just a couple dormitories. Most of the students came from Grand Rapids. They were day students, if you will. So it was my first introduction with kids from the east side of the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we grow up here in St. Joe. All our TV is from Chicago.
Right.
We know very little about Detroit as a young person. So that was very interesting. I learned a whole lot about the other side of the state, what they were interested in, what was going on over there. Grand Valley was a great school. The one thing that struck me, all their classes were 5 credits. So you took 3 classes, which as an incoming freshman was fabulous because you just focused on 3 classes.
Yeah.
And they had this mandatory time with the professors. And so I got into writing in my freshman year, mostly fiction. And that's... Maybe that served me well in elections. But.
Well, when you graduated, what kind of a degree did you have? What was your major?
Well, I ended up at Michigan State University, mm-hmm. and I graduated in political science. And I'm always kind of tell folks I'm one of the few jobs that is actually a political science job that's not in academia. It was a political science. And I actually was very interested in urban government. And that was kind of the heyday back in the late 60s, early 70s, before a lot of the Great Society funding was cut. So I studied that as sort of a minor in political science and was very interested in city government.
What did you do with your degree?
Well, you know, I decide, well, if you got one, you might as well get two, right? And so I went off to St. Louis University down in St. Louis. And I got a master's degree in urban affairs. And it was at St. Louis University, a Catholic school right in the middle of St. Louis. And all the faculty were very much involved in grants and whatnot, of actually working with the urban government of St. Louis, St. Louis County, with various projects that were, to me, very exciting. So I got that degree and got out in 74.
What kind of projects were you involved in?
Well, a lot of them were with parks that I found fascinating. When they were starting to look at linear parks, they were finding all this abandoned railroad property that went through a lot of communities, and they could put these great parks together. Also in housing and kind of crime prevention in terms of what neighborhoods could do that wanted to stay in the urban environment, yet pull together as a community to make sure crime kind of stayed outside of their streets.
You know, it's interesting because when I was in the U.S. Department of Justice, I came up with a program called Weed and Seed, which was a community rehabilitation, a neighborhood rehabilitation program that worked on getting rid of the weeds, that would be the gangs, the drugs, violence, yes. Guns, whatever. And then the seeding was to improve the neighborhood, bring it together, and to deal on a very micro level. So if there was an unemployment problem, it wasn't just we need jobs generally, it was this particular group of people, these 5 kids.
Right.
And we would bring in people from government, from churches, schools, institutions of foundations, universities, and so on, labor unions, business, all of this. We designed it so the U.S. attorney would be the person who would bring people together, but it was the neighbors that would decide what it was that needed to be done.
Absolutely, and that's what makes it work. And without that cohesion, it's just throwing a lot of money
right.
that doesn't get it done.
And money does not solve problems. People solve problems with the assistance of money.
it was interesting back at that time, not to get too far off topic here, but, you know, the money that used to come from Washington would go to the mayors. And the governors were going, most of the money from Washington comes through the governor and the state level and then is dispersed down. And these CAP programs, community action programs, that was their whole design was to, and they became very active, and they were activists, and oftentimes even mayors found out that they created a political movement that may have stepped on their toes as well. But all that got cut out in the early 70s. By the mid-70s, most of that was gone.
Well, what happened after you got your second degree?
I did get a third degree, but later. Not right away. I was decided that, you know, I had a family and everything. It's time to get in the real world. So I came back to St. Joe and from St. Louis and started job hunting and found that these programs had dried up. And really the whole urban thing was not what was bringing people like me into employment. So finally, in the spring of 1974, I said, well, I'm going to Washington to find a job. And so my wife and daughter stayed here, and I went to Washington and ran into I had a relative who housed me for a while. And after a few weeks, it's kind of like, okay, you know what they say about fish, you know, after it's time for you to move on.
Yeah.
I ran into a very dear friend from high school, Michael Shore, who let me sleep on the floor of his apartment. And I tromped around Capitol Hill looking for a job. And it was literally 2 months before President Nixon resigned. And it was a very interesting time in Washington, D.C. Also, nobody was hiring. I mean, the whole focus of that town was on the daily news that came out.
I mean, whether or not he was going to be impeached or whatever. I remember
Supreme Court well. And what they were doing. Yep. It just, the whole place was a buzz. And, of course, the House had the impeachment hearings going on. And it was an amazing time to be there. But I did land a job. And I landed a job because I could type 55 words a minute without any mistakes.
All right.
And everyone on Capitol Hill back in the day, they pushed them through a typing test. And so I got into the Office of Records and Registration, which sounds like a very important office, right? And that office handled the campaign finance disclosure reporting for candidates and members of the House of Representatives. It was before the Federal Election Commission. And so I ran an MTSing machine, which was a precursor as a Wang. And so all the form letters were on this. And so I ran that. And there are all these young people were in this office, and they're all there attached to one member or not. It was mostly clerical work with all these degrees. You know, we had BAs and BSs and MSs and all that. But we were pushing a lot of paper pretty well. And so I had two functions in there. One is that I did the form letters, and the other was I kept everybody's resume on there. So when they would go job, it's one of these places where you kind of moved on. You know?
Absolutely.
And so it was lots of fun and back in those days, and very exciting. But Richard Nixon's resignation and Watergate brought the Federal Election Commission along. A woman who hired me, her name was Fran Vorty. Her father was the mayor of South Bend for years and had been killed in a car crash. And so these two daughters of his were on Capitol Hill. And so I worked for her, and she ran the office at the time. And she went to the Federal Election Commission, and then she brought me along with her. So I ended up in public communications over there and ran a staff that we had toll-free lines. Was like the big innovation in 1975. And we took calls from people running for Congress, their treasurers, on how to comply with this new, fairly complicated disclosure law.
Disclosure of what?
So these would be election expenses, where they got their money from contributors, how they spent that money, We also worked with the legal people very closely in terms of very replete regulations that they promulgated, and then people would be asking us scenarios. Well, if I do this, can I, you know, get away with that? You know, so we became pretty proficient. Lawyers didn't like to be on that front line, so we would work closely with them and learned a lot about how you applied law and regulation. So we dealt with hundreds and hundreds of calls a week, trying to bring people on so they could disclose, and we made it public. The agency made it public. So
we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Chris Thomas, who has just recently retired from the position of Director of Elections for the state of Michigan. We're going to be talking a lot more about that job in a minute or so. But so far, we've been talking about his background getting into politics sort of because he needed a job. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Chris Thomas, the former retired Bureau of Elections Director for the state of Michigan. And we're talking about not just his background, but elections generally and why we do certain things and how it all fits together. This is John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Chris, you're in the boiler room. And a bunch of you guys are answering telephone calls, and because we now have a new thing called the Federal Election Commission and campaign disclosure. Where do our candidates get their money? Where do they spend their money? And it's not just, I'm going to take one step ahead, it's not just a, gee, why don't you do it? There were mandatory requirements, and there were criminal penalties.
Absolutely, and there were lots of limits, too, on how much you could take and who you could take them from and what corporations could do and what unions could do and what nonprofits could do. So it's a fairly complex set of law and regulation that attempts to stop certain things and disclose as much as possible. And it is mandatory, and it was fairly new. There was in 71 was the first act that really got into disclosure, and by 74, that's where the prohibitions came in. That's where Watergate was principally about money. There was a huge money piece to that of corporations being shaken down for a percentage of their profits, for example. A lot of cash flowing around, suitcases full of it. Cash was pretty much prohibited. Had to be written instruments so you could track all of this. So, yes, it was for the Ma and Pa congressional campaign out there, it was a lot of new hoops to jump through.
Did you have a lot of resistance from the people who were in office as well as the people on the outside?
There was a little bit of that. What happened is that people on the inside realized that they were more capable of managing it than people on the outside. For people on the outside that were just coming into politics, that was a big step. And you know, the treasurer used to be kind of an honorary position and you'd keep track of some stuff. Well, now, as you notice, full of criminal penalties, do's and don'ts, detailed periodic disclosure throughout the year. So it was a big step. And many people had to hire. You had to pay an accountant to help you out on it.
Well, what happened after you answered your last telephone call? Where did you go from there?
I came back to Michigan.
Yeah.
I was I don't know if you remember Neil Stabler.
I do.
He's
yeah.
An institution in Michigan, and he was a commissioner, one of the original commissioners at the Federal Election Commission. And so he was contacted by the Secretary of State, Richard Austin, saying they've just passed a new campaign finance law in Michigan. This was in right after the 1976 election. And they sent a group out to Washington to get a tour of the Federal Election Commission. So Neil Stabler says, "You're from Michigan, you give the tour." And so I did. And I got to know these people. They're great people. And as a non-lawyer at the time, Washington, D.C. is an extremely expensive place to live.
Oh, absolutely.
And it felt like you're going backwards. We lived in Reston, Virginia, which is 25 miles out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're talking about an hour, hour and a half bus ride every day. And all of a sudden, Michigan looked very good. And so we came back to Michigan. I went to work for the Secretary of State's office to put together their campaign finance management. And that's where my love was. I hadn't done anything in election administration. It was all campaign finance. That was the new kid on the block, if mm-hmm. you will.
But in the state of Michigan, there was, in the old days, nothing in terms of regulating campaign expenditures or income, just like there wasn't at the federal level.
That's right.
But then Michigan, I take it, came up with its own rules.
Came up with its own rules. They passed this fabulous law. I'm talking as a regulator now, okay? power, yeah. Right. So as a regulator, oh, and 75 is a beautiful law.
Yeah.
And it had a commission, and it had subpoena authority and cease and desist authority, and it did campaign finance, lobby disclosure and registration, and conflict of interest.
Whoa.
Yeah, disclosure of where your investments and incomes are. So by categories.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it got declared unconstitutional because there were too many subjects in the bill.
That's a technical reason with the Michigan Constitution and legislative practice.
That's correct.
You have to have one
subject matter
for a bill.
Yes.
So if you put too many in there.
They said you had too many.
All right, go ahead.
So they redid the campaign finance. That was the first piece they put through. And that's when I came back to Michigan. It was only campaign finance. Secretary of State was doing it all. No commission. No subpoena.
Ooh.
No cease and desist. We had, you know, it was, but good disclosure. It was a good disclosure law, and the limits were reasonable, and it had public funding for the gubernatorial primary and general election. Very forward thinking in that respect at the time. So there was plenty to do, and so we rolled our sleeves up and I think did a pretty good job there. In 78, they passed the lobbyist disclosure, and they made half the state government lobbyists. I was a lobbyist.
Really?
Yeah. They included state employees in there who went over to the legislature and testified on bills they wanted. They never gave us any money to hand out to anybody. We couldn't buy people meals or anything like that.
Oh, what a disappointment.
Yeah, so I never really considered myself a lobbyist, but the law did. And then conflict of interest, crickets. That is, Michigan is one of the only states, there might be two, that does not require some sort of disclosure of where your interests are as an office holder, your financial interests. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. It's talked about on occasion, but not seriously.
Well, we're going to be talking a bit later about where we can make things better. Mm-hmm. But right now we're just talking about how it is and was as you went through.
Yeah.
So your view when you first got in, you were brought in to deal with campaign finance. That morphed into other kinds of activities which are involved in people seeking office. Lobbyist is another. When they get into office, people can people on the outside talk to congresspersons or senators or state senators or reps, that sort of thing.
Right.
Where did you go from there?
Well, I stayed with the department, and the Secretary of State's department, and I had a wonderful mentor, Bernie Apel.
Mm-hmm.
He was Mr. Elections,
yep.
In my view, still has that title, and he was a wonderful man, particularly for kind of a young kid that is in his late 20s and mm-hmm. pretty gung-ho about, so he taught me a lot of the ropes and, mm-hmm. you know, how to kind of maneuver around the Lansing scene and introduced me to election administration, which I thought at the time was kind of a bunch of old, boring stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I found he retired in 1980, and there was an interim, and then I became director in 1981. And that has opened a whole new field for me.
At this point, I'm going to step in and say something that you haven't said, but I will tell you that your term, your tenure as director of elections was marked by very, very few, if any, challenges to your integrity. You came out of your time in that position, surprisingly, with an extraordinarily high reputation for fairness and efficiency. And I say that because I've been involved in this world for from either the sideline or in the thick of it for a lot of years here. And your reputation is outstanding. Now, I don't want to say too many nice things about you because I may want to attack some of the things
right.
you do. But at any rate, so where do we go from there?
Well, you know, I want to just say, you know, following on that point a little bit, we had an office that had its own mores, that Bernie Apel and Jim Chapman, these two gents who started in 1952 when the Bureau of Elections was put together after the Soapy William recounts. That was the genesis of that office. And so we stood on their shoulders. We've always felt that way and have kind of pounded that into the younger people we've hired over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I get some credit for all of that. But that's where we started, and we stayed with that.
So what did you pound into those young people's ears?
We pounded in the fact that you are not here as a political person. You are here to basically be a referee, if you will. We wear the striped shirts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a body of law and procedure, and as soon as we lean one way or the other, our reputation is tainted, and then our ability to say we're running fair elections is out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have irritated to no end both parties, without question. But I think we've bent over backwards to be able to show why we were doing what we're doing and stand on the law and court precedents throughout. A good cadre of lawyers, election lawyers in the state, were also very helpful because, you know, one day they'd be green light, next day they'd be red light in terms of people getting on the ballot, getting off the ballot. And so we worked together. I mean, we all had our role to play. And then finally, I had good secretaries of state. I never had one that tried to pull me into a political decision. I never had one who sat down and brought me into the political machinations of their office. And a lot of people think, well, geez, you know, the election's headed by an elected official. You know, how can it's either a Democrat or Republican, how can that be fair? And the only way that's fair is that they keep an arm's length. And while there are some decisions they can make, they're the elected person, they're the policymaker. So when it comes to what laws they want to push, that's their area. But they pretty much let us run our offices. And that was helpful. That started right with Richard Austin, who never interfered with anything.
Well, let's just take a few minutes before the break and say, look, You had Richard Austin, who was there for 20-plus years.
Yes.
He was a Democrat.
Yes.
He retired, and the next one was Terry Land.
Candace Miller. Yes.
Republican.
Republican.
Then?
She did 8 years, was term limited out.
Right. Then it was?
Then Terry Lynn Land. She did her 8 years, was termed out. And now Ruth Johnson, who is just finishing her last year, and will be termed out.
So, putting them all together, they're about the same, the Democrat, Republican, in terms of time,
yes.
they're about the same amount of time.
Yes.
And I'm really happy to hear from you, because we'll get into that in a minute, but I'm happy to hear that it was they kept their hands off
yes.
the electoral process.
Yeah. You remember Hugh McDermott?
I do.
Yeah, he was this columnist from the Free Press.
And, right.
He had a little bite to him.
More than a little bite.
Yeah,
part of my body was taken
yeah.
off.
But he wrote this column to Candace Miller when she came in and right after the election in 1994. Now, Richard Austin wasn't termed out. He was defeated.
Right. He was defeated.
She beat
That's
him,
right.
and, which is pretty amazing, you know.
Yeah.
She wrote this column that says, Hugh McDermott wrote the column saying to her, don't worry about the other party. Worry about your friends. They're the ones that are going to come and ask you to do things that you shouldn't do. And that's true. I know every one of those have been pushed into positions by other politicians and party people of their party to take an action, to get the Bureau of Elections to do this, or to say this in front of the Board of State Canvassers. And it really, they haven't done it.
Bless their souls.
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Chris Thomas, who recently retired director of the Bureau of Elections for the state of Michigan, a part of the Secretary of State's office. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. And we're going to be talking about some fun things that happened, some tough things that happened, but also we're going to talk about how do we make elections better? How do we make good people get into office, not be scared off? A lot of different things. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Chris Thompson, the recently retired director of the Bureau of Elections, part of the state Secretary of State's office, and as I said, got a great reputation for fairness and honesty in the supervision of the refereeing about our elections. This is John Smetanka. So, Chris, all these people out there want the elections to go their way.
Yes.
They go out, they spend a lot of money. Often
yes.
they spend other people's money.
Yes.
They raise money. I know that was the hardest thing, by far the hardest thing that I had to do as a candidate anywhere was to ask people for their money. I tell people that I would go up to somebody new and I can easily say, hi, I'm John Smetanka, I'm running for such and such, and could you give me your vote? But then I have to say the other magic words, and could you give me some money? And it's hard.
It is hard.
There's two people in my whole life in politics who liked to raise money, and I won't say who they were, but people would recognize their names, at least the ones that I've seen. The rest of us hated it. Now, but people are pushing because money is involved. Power is involved, the ability to shape the laws of the state and how they're applied, how judges are elected who gets in, who doesn't get in. All of those things are intimately at the base related to elections?
Yes, they are.
All right. Tell me about how a day went or how a week or a year went with all those pressures. And any interesting things that stick out in your mind?
Well, you know, we live in the election year. There used to be this big off year, you know, the odd-numbered years. Hey, nothing's going on. And then the election year. Well, now it's just 24/7. I mean, when I started, we had four phone lines. And when four people were talking to us, you got a busy signal. They didn't have voicemail. Well, now it's almost impossible to get a busy signal. And with email and all of that, and texting and social media, the amount of information that is put out is just phenomenal. And the communication with candidates and voters and whatnot is phenomenal. What you find with the money side of it, those were some of our hardest times. I mean, we had some tough times there. Bill Lucas ran for governor in 1986, and he was the county exec in Wayne County over by Detroit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was going and, you know, would running against Jim Blanchard for his second term.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to apply for public funds, which had $1 million spending limit, which sounded like a lot of money, but is not anymore.
Nothing.
It's nothing anymore. Back then, early 80s, big deal. We wouldn't give it to him because he had spent all of this local money he had out there running for governor. And we said, not until you tell us when you became a candidate so that gets rolled into your limit,
mm-hmm.
you know, applies against your limit. And so that was a hard one. We went back and forth for several months.
Mm-hmm.
But those things, you kind of have to draw your line in the sand and stick to them. So that was a tough run. Typically in election year, the ballot proposals can get very, very contentious.
What is a ballot proposal?
So Michigan's constitution reserves to the people the ability to amend the constitution, to initiate laws, and to recall almost all officers other than judicial office holders. So that process, not every state does that. 24 or so. So we have a lot of leeway, and it's a contentious process. So anyone who's doing that, either initiating a law or amending the Constitution, is doing so generally against the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature hasn't enacted this law. I mean, take marijuana, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't enacted legalization of marijuana. So it's going to be done by petition, and then the voters will decide. Now, the legislature had an option. They chose not to enact it, and June 5th was their deadline. So it will be on the ballot this year. Constitutional amendments, same way. And they're contentious issues. Sometimes they're economic issues. Sometimes there's social issues, and a lot of tax issues have been on.
Parochial, aid to parochial schools,
yes, that was very
abortion. You've got marijuana. You've got how do we go about reapportioning our congressional delegation? All of these things can be. I remember Brooks Patterson back in the 70s wanted to reinstate the death penalty.
Yes.
And he, at the same time as he was pushing that, he also pushed Proposition B or something like that concerning mandatory sentences.
Yes.
And changing good time, taking away good time from prisoners.
78. Yes.
78.
Yes.
And ironically, in some of those cases, they win, and some of those cases, the people say no. And
that's
in
right.
fact, I always think about in 1978, the people in a county that I know of voted to, right along with Brooks Patterson, to take away good time and extend the sentences of the people who are incarcerated. At the very same time, they voted down having a county jail to handle the people that they were bringing in.
That's what follows, yes. That's,
and there's people vote for different reasons.
Yes.
They have different needs or wants or angers or joys.
Yes.
And there you go.
Yeah, it's just which one pushes your button. You know, there was talk on the marijuana that, well, there's some who believe it's going to increase turnout by 3%. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's kind of a political thought that was there. Some thought, well, it might advantage this political party.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just go ahead and act it into law, then that's taken care of. And then the other thing is when you do enact a law by that initiative that the people enact, it takes a 3/4 vote to amend it.
Ah, which, that's right. That's right.
And that's tough to get.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, I think, some legitimate thinking, well, let's, because a lot of these things are not all that well put together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Legislative Service Bureau doesn't write it. People bring what they want to put before the people, and, you know, the courts will decide usually after the election. So we have a lot of different contentious ballot proposals over the years. I remember the real contentious was when you get down to the 100 words.
Mm-hmm.
It was my job to write the 100 words, and the Board of Canvassers could either, they could reject it or approve it, but they couldn't really write their own. I had to agree.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. So I think the one that I caught the most gas on was the assisted suicide.
Mm.
And I use the word suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And time Senator Pierce from Ann Arbor, he's a doctor, and he was a sponsor of that.
Mm-hmm.
He never forgave me. I know that. And it went down. I mean, it went on the ballot, and it went down. And I didn't do it for that reason, but I thought, well, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and what other word are you going to use?
Yeah.
You know, so... It comes down to those kinds of concerns.
So we know that you dealt with in the Election Bureau with ballot proposals, whether it's to change the Constitution or to create a law, candidates getting on the ballot. Now,
yes.
We provide in our state for a couple of different ways for a candidate who wants to run to get on a ballot.
Right.
What are they?
Well, everybody has a petition route.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone says, well, it's the most arcane form of getting on a ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. Many offices also have, as an alternative, a filing fee.
Okay.
But some offices don't. Congressional offices do not.
Okay.
Not as yet. It's floated around as proposals, but right now you've got to put your money down. And same with statewide offices and judicial offices.
Mm-hmm.
Judges are not real crazy about lawyers being able to just come in and drop $100 down and run for office. So there's a little bit of that too.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's funny. So some locals... some township offices are by filing fee and school offices, but not a number of others.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get into some of the arcaneness of, okay, what's a good signature? And the law says, well, you'll put your name, your address, and the date you sign the petition. And it seems pretty straightforward.
It does, from what you described it.
It is incredible what people do when you put a pen in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Same with ballots. You wouldn't believe how people complete marks on a paper ballot.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very strange. And so there's this whole body of law and practice that the courts have upheld or overturned that say what's a good signature and what's not. People put P.O. box in when it says street address,
mm-hmm.
Number and street. They put a P.O. box in. No good. Or they sign and date it, but there's a circulator who is the one that brought you that petition and asked you to sign it, and that person signs it and dates it also. So your signing as a voter has to be either that same day or earlier. If it's later, mm-hmm. then when that circulator. So sometimes you get a circulator who will sign a date at the day they start circulating the page.
Mm.
And then everybody on there the next day, those are all thrown out. So those are, and then Michigan has this extremely decentralized system.
Mm-hmm.
Most states run county-based. So you could sign a petition from Berrien County, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, until the 70s, and then that changed later on more widely, you had to use a city and township petition sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably 30-some different cities and townships in Berrien County.
Right.
And if you have St. Joe and St. Joe Township, you cannot put them on the same piece of paper. Now, you can today. They finally said, okay, you can do county-wide petition sheets.
Okay.
But you still have to designate, is it the city of or the township of? It's those small little things that, if not done properly, can end up disqualifying a candidate.
We're going to take another break right now. We're talking to Chris Thomas, who is the recently retired director of the Bureau of Elections for the state of Michigan, working in the Secretary of State's office. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back and talk about how we can improve things. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Chris Thomas, the recently retired director of the Bureau of Elections, not investigation. I've got the FBI in my mind. Bureau of Elections in the Secretary of State's office, whose responsibility is to supervise how we run our elections. And we were just talking about the question of signatures and how a person gets their name on a ballot and how technical it has become. So I want to put it to you this way. We have this petition route, and every year we hear, every 2 years or every 4 years, we hear complaints just like you described. Oh, this person had the wrong signatures. They're just screwed up, and so wipe them out, and now they're no longer candidates. That's hard for the public to accept. On the other hand, there's a reason for petitions, and what is that? Is there a reason?
The reason is to show a modicum of public support. So you're not going to just say anyone who wants to sign up, come write your name here, and we'll put you on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was setting some standard that says, okay, you've shown enough support to warrant being placed on a ballot. Now, those have to be accurate. They have to really reflect mm-hmm. registered voters.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got an intersection here of technology and that has changed and law that perhaps hasn't kept up. So one of the major advances Michigan did in the 90s was create the qualified voter file, statewide voter registration system. Up until that time, it was balkanization. There were 1,500 cities and townships. They each had their own shoebox, their own registered voters. There was no communication between the two or the three or the 1,500. And so under Candace Miller, as we implemented the National Voter Registration Act, we did a statewide voter registration file, which tied it to the driver's license and connected all these 1,500 jurisdictions. Massive. All these other states, they would have had just do 83 counties, and that would have been it.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to deal with 1,500 plus the counties, 83. We're up to 1,600. So now we know where everybody is. In the olden days, part of that checkbox deal about whether you're in St. Joe or St. Joe City or St. Joe Township was the court said that the state didn't have to travel to two places to figure out where your signer lives. That's your responsibility to, as a candidate, to do that correctly. Well, now we do have a state, you know, we've got a qualified voter file. That's there. We know where everybody is, and I think there likely will be some changes coming. And there have been major changes, minor changes.
We have had, in my law practice, I have seen a number of situations in which voters are lost when it comes to where they're supposed to be voting, what precinct, what county, whatever. There are students who vote or want to vote, and they what do they vote in their at their university where they're living most of the time or back home? Military people, people who are living elsewhere temporarily, and they still want to vote where they're registered.
Right.
And then you have people who, all right, they cheat.
Yes.
They want to vote in two or three or four places, you know, and we joke about in Chicago, vote early and often.
Right.
Or if you can't vote five times, why vote at all?
Yeah.
And so on. Those jokes aren't really funny when it comes to, you know, when you're a candidate.
Right.
And you work your heart out and you take all the abuse that that is given in big dollops to candidates these days, and then somebody screws it up,
right,
and you lose by five votes, and those five votes, you know, I know that there was a fraud someplace. I just know that. And so people live and breathe, I was cheated.
Right. We're lucky not to have that culture in Michigan. I mean, you know, we all grew up, like I said before, with Chicago in our backyards. I don't want to disparage them. I think their act's been cleaned up somewhat as well. But it is a cultural thing. And we've, fortunately, Michigan's not had it, which doesn't say there isn't some cheating. Of course there is. But it's not widespread, and it's not rampant. And it generally manifests itself. You find it. You will generally find a lot of it if it is going on. You know, we've had some cases around here. They've gotten some notoriety.
Yes, they have.
And but they were discoverable. They were discoverable and were discovered. So, you know, I don't have the fear of some under the radar large fraud going on. We've had candidates from both parties with their challengers and all the polling places. And the thing with these statewide voter registration files, the parties get the file. They can buy it for $23. You can get your 7.4 million voters. Then you can check as many of them out as you want. So on that side, I'm very comfortable. But it is always this vigilance of the balance. And the balance is you can't make it so high on the security end that you're cutting off people's access. So it is that balance of keeping the barriers as low as possible, but high enough that you're secure that it's a well-run election.
Well, one of the big controversies is on all the talk shows and everywhere is, can the Russians run our elections? Can they affect our elections? Because now that we're computerized, what if some hacker, doesn't have to be the Russians, it can be just a couple of kids in a garage, can they throw our elections into serious question?
Well, I think the answer to that is it'd be very difficult. Now, the Russians certainly had the resources to do it. The point is they've been here at this since 2014. It was not just 2016 that they started. And this is on the, not on the Facebook side, but on the side of trying to enter statewide registration files. They have not been successful with one state for sure, which is Illinois. They got in there. The no data was changed. They got in. They think there might be four or five other states where maybe they got in. So what could they do? They could create chaos, right? They could change records so that when people showed up on election day, they were very confused and mm-hmm. their name didn't show up. There are processes for handling that, but they would not be a fun day.
Mm-hmm.
So they're what's going on now nationally and within each state is those security walls are being vastly improved.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan, I was there in 16. We dealt with Homeland Security. We were confident that we never had any breach whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And in most states are that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it takes more than that. So the other side of it is, can you change the election results?
Mm-hmm.
And
so we're not going to mess with the names of the people. That's just irritating people.
Yes.
But now can we go in after the election, all the votes are in, and all of a sudden,
right,
electronically change it?
Yeah. And there, I think the answer is, I mean, you never say never, but essentially extremely difficult. We've got tabulators that are not connected to the internet that create a paper record. First of all, we're using paper ballots.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, like we started in December of 16, we started a hand recount of the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And we got through 40% of it before the court shut it down. So that is, you know, we're not really electronic in terms of touch screens. We've got paper. You've got the original voter source. The tabulators the paper goes into are not connected to the internet. The equipment in the county office, which accumulates the data, the unofficial results on election night, are not connected to the internet. So the ability to get in is very, very limited. Then you've got 3 weeks, 2 weeks at the county, a week at the state for canvassing. They go back, they take that paper printout for each precinct and each candidate, and they look at that piece of paper that came out of that tabulator to make sure those are all the same. They do that audit.
Mm-hmm.
And Michigan is now doing post-election audits where they'll actually count a limited number of ballots on a random basis. So there are many, many safeguards. It'd be very, very difficult. We've got over 4,800 precincts out there. It can be no larger than 3,000. Average size is probably around 1,000 to 1,500.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult to pull anything off.
I was a co-chairman of a commission in Grand Rapids to make mm-hmm. sure to review how the elections some years ago, actually two sets of elections, how they went. It was a revelation to me how complex it all is.
It's very complex.
And yet how many people of good faith and skill are working to make sure that the elections are going well and going fairly. And it is, you know, I was actually, even though we found some things which could have been done better.
Yes.
It was still.
I mean, first of all, the checks and balances are,
yeah.
And that's the complexity.
Right.
And then second of all, on election day, there's probably 35,000 people working
mm-hmm.
in Michigan. It's the largest part-time workforce in the state. And these are our neighbors.
Yeah.
These are not professionals that this is their regular job.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are dealing with the complexity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very well done.
Chris Thomas, thank you very much for your time. We could talk all night about this, all day and all night. But thank you very much for your time and also for your service that was has been well lauded. And I thank you for on my behalf for some of the things that you have done during my things that I had to do in the course of elections and getting them straight. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Saturday, Sunday, and Thursday Until next time, remember, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.